the following contains strong language and adult content. We tried to tell our hosts that they'll be talking about manga targeted at Japanese teenage boys, but they demanded access to what they call fuck words. So, here we are. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Shonen Fiasco Show, the number one book club for the self-loathing weeb. I am the rootin' tootinest podcast host of the West, Adam Tetramore.
Just in time for Halloween, it's spooky Alex Hill.
Well, you know what? How are you spooky? What are you dressed as for Halloween? Because I'm clearly a cowboy, as you could see through our no-camera Google call. And I can't tell from your no-call Google call what you are for Halloween, just that you're spooky. What's your plan for Halloween?
I mean, I'm pretty spooky. I'm going to Halloween dressed as a almost 30-year-old man trapped in the hellscape that is COVID.
Every episode, we rag on 2020. Oh, what happens when we get into 2021? We run out of banter.
Well, that's when we run into the golden age, and just all the manga and Shonen Jump is just killer. They don't cancel anything.
We don't go to
space. We have to go to aliens to get new manga to see what they canceled, and we have to learn new languages. And
what you've got going on in life? What's the plan?
Well, I've started Christmas music recording. Actually, in the end of September, rolling into the beginning of October already. I've gotten a couple gigs. I've been knocking them out, and I'm just like, I'm not ready. I want Halloween. I want zombies.
So you're already in the grips of the Christmas spirit.
Unfortunately, so.
I guess that gives you the future sight of what 2020 Christmas is going to be like. What's the biggest heads up you can give us? What's the biggest foreshadowing for what the Christmas to come?
It's going to be buried in snow, just like in Final Fantasy VII.
That's all I want. If we got to talk about Christmas, that's all I want is snow. We can get rid of the holiday. I ain't buying nothing for nobody.
No, yeah, I feel it. I feel we're going to have some snow. Because last time we had any semblance of snow was 2 years ago. Like, when I was looking to move up here to Virginia, coming from Tennessee, I'm like, wow, this is so far up north, I'm sure I'll get some snow. And it snowed so much, it just like shut down the town. Like, you look outside and it was just crazy amount of snow. And I was like, man, this is what I get to look forward to. It'll be like living in Chicago again. And then we never saw snow ever again.
I'll tell you one thing I'm actually excited about. So, sticking on holiday events, my Halloween is actually going to be used to attend a wedding.
Ooh, a dress-up wedding, I hope.
It is we dress up, we show up, and it's a wedding. We are very professional and whatnot. But you're not wrong. I really have to fight the temptation to come in as a ghost and throughout the entire event, just interrupt with the occasional, sorry, y'all. Sorry, I didn't mean to. It slipped out.
Right when they're like, if anyone has anything to say about this marriage, speak now or forever hold your... relationships past.
No, it's fine. They're great. I like it. That was just a compulsion. Beyond that, I've been sick, trying to deal with a little bit of like a head cold, dealing with allergies and whatnot. But in the meantime, I have picked up, and I'm so excited, the first volume of Chainsaw Man.
Oh, interesting. I've heard you talk about it.
Out in the West. Yeah, it's been amazing because I tell everyone in my house, read Chainsaw Man, support Chainsaw Man. And now I have a physical copy. And because of this physical copy, two of the people in my household have already read through the entire volume. And they're like, yeah, this is great. And I get so much serotonin just watching people read it and go, ha! I'm like, yeah!
Yeah. I'll definitely add that to my list because I know I finished watching JoJo Part 5, so I want to read 6.
How did you enjoy JoJo Part 5?
I loved it. It was delightful. The characters were really neat. There's only a couple of complaints that I have, and it's just about not getting enough screen time on certain people's stands. But everything entailed, I very much loved it. I'm hella excited to start 6 now.
Rank it.
Where did I put 5?
Where did you put 5 out of the 5?
Out of the 5, I would put 5 at number 2. Number 1's still the second half of Part 4 for me.
Wait a minute. I feel like that's cheating.
Oh, is that cheating? Oh, okay. If I want to say the best from start to finish
that's
is
right.
Part 5.
Wow.
I would give that to number one because, like, part one's great, super short. Part two is fantastic. Part three is, like, interesting at the beginning, boring in the middle, awesome at the end. Part four is crap for the first half, great for the second half. But part five, just the whole time, it's just, like, it's very engaging, so.
Well, we're not here to talk about JoJo, and we're not even here to talk about Chainsaw Man. We're here to talk about series in Shonen Jump that failed to reach 50 chapters. And for our seventh episode, we have a bit of a classic. This is a 20-year-old series. And I think a lot of this particular episode is going to be talking about basically what manga was in the year 2000. This is actually a bit of a time capsule to show, like, what Shonen was at its bare essentials in the year 2000. Because I've read the series before when I was a kid, but reading it in 2020 is absolutely a culture shock, I feel like. Yeah,
absolutely.
I'm excited to get to it. In that case, let's go ahead and get to the pitch. Somewhere in the desert of the Wild West lies the world's greatest treasure, the 12 Rings of the Dead. The only source of the mysterious substance, zombie powder, which can raise the dead and grant eternal life. Into this world stalks Gamma Akutabi, a cybernetically enhanced martial arts master with a metal arm and a 6-foot chainsaw. Against an army of crooks and killers, runaway trains, and superpowered madmen, he'll need all of his skills as well as a team of bandits to back him up. But the most dangerous thing in the West just might be the rings themselves. From the mind of the legendary Taito Kubo, this is Zombie Powder.
Yeehaw.
We're going Zombie Powder.
We're going to cybernetic dystopian Wild West times as of the year 2000. I like Trigun. I like the Cowboy Bebop.
Yeah, you hit this up right at the beginning.
Yeah, Zombie Powder might be a series that some of our older listeners, not older, not like boomer tier, but, you know, it's not completely unfamiliar if you were a fan of Jump as of, you know, the mid-2000s to 2010s, especially if you were a fan of the author in question, Taito Kubo, which I've learned this. It is spelled T-I-T-E. It is pronounced Taito.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know why. I think he's... Listen,
I'll have to take a look at his hiragana, because I haven't seen his name written out.
I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case, because Kubo is, in fact, one of those weirdos. Like, okay, have you seen a picture of Taito Kubo?
Yes.
Do you know the picture I'm talking about?
Is the one with the sunglasses with, like, the Terminator-looking sunglasses?
He looks like the coolest guy on the planet in this picture, and that is the only picture we ever see him in. He has these sunglasses on, and he's just like, yeah, whatever, I write manga. And I'm like, God, I want to be Taito Kubo when I grow up.
I'm not going to lie, I had, like, a moment when I looked at him because, like, getting out of high school me looks exactly like him. Like, I had that same kind of long hair swept to a side with, like, the barely little bit of a beard, maybe deciding to be a soul patch. And the biggest sunglasses you could find. Oh my gosh, it tickles me.
Zombie Powder ran in Weekly Shonen Jump from July of 1999 to February of 2000. The series ran for 27 chapters and 4 volumes. You can find close to the entire series on the Shonen Jump app. For whatever reason, at the time of this recording, the final chapter is not on the app. So you might have to get creative with that. Zombie Powder also received a prevalent run in Western markets, so it shouldn't be too hard to find English volumes to this day. If you go to a Second and Charles and a Barnes & Noble and whatnot, it's honestly not exactly a rare series to find in the West. This is the debut series for legendary mangaka Taito Kubo, who would eventually go on to find his biggest commercial success in the 74-volume supernatural shonen action behemoth Bleach. And is also currently running, or not currently, most recently ran in Shonen Jump with the short series Burn the Witch. This is going to be our first series that flopped, and then immediately afterwards, this author just figured it out,
saw the biggest amount of success and is still considered a super commercially viable and popular artist.
Right. He's such a cool mangaka that he looks like he's pulled straight out of one of the Yakuza games.
I would not be surprised if one of the older Yakuza games has him as like a cameo character.
They put Michael Jackson in there, so I'm sure.
You never know.
You never know.
There's a lot of notoriety with this guy, and it's kind of a mix of, it's just mimetic. There's a reputation with him that you can see in this series in a lot of ways. Like, you could see a lot of the habits that Kubo's notorious for in this series, and it's super interesting to see how much of that style is stuck to him. If you read this series having read Bleach before, you will immediately recognize this as like, oh, it's a Kubo joint. Even though the series itself isn't that interesting, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's vanilla Shonen Jump.
Yeah, that is a great way to describe it. But I can absolutely see, and I'm sure we'll talk more of this later in the podcast, that this is definitely one where he threw out a bunch of concepts that he has had like working ideas for, or something that he enjoys, like tropes or type of characters that he, after this flops, he's like, how do I tweak this to make this better? And then those kind of characters reoccur in his later stuff. And I think you can see some of the foundations of that through this manga, even though this manga is not that great.
Alex, did you read Bleach?
I read a good chunk of it, but I never finished it, and I don't think I got mega, mega far. I read some Bleach, and I watched the anime as well.
I was a huge Bleach fan when I was a kid, and I think I had the same experience that a lot of people had, was I love it, I love it, I love it, I'm less in love with it, I'm falling out of love with it, I'm reading it out of obligation, okay, I'm sick of it. And then it ended.
Yeah.
In any case, we're not here to talk about Bleach, we're trying to talk about this series, Zombie Powder, and we can go ahead and get started with the opening chapters. Our story begins specifically at 3:16 p.m. on August 2nd, the year 716 AE, in the Wild West-inspired town of Blue Note, South Wyster. None of this is helpful information, but it's information. A young man named Elwood finds himself at the mercy of a local gang as he hands a stack of cash over to an absurdly obese crime lord. This kingpin, known as King Crow, praises the boy for his talents and promises to keep his criminal activity a secret from his sister, a statement that makes the boy shudder. In another part of town, a mysterious individual sporting long white hair and a silver coat arrives by bus and attracts the attention of nearly every resident of this Wild West town. This attention follows him to the local saloon as he chats with the bartender about the reason for his arrival. The strange visitor is searching for artifacts known as the Rings of Death.
But I thought there was only one ring to rule them all.
It's 12.
More?
Yeah, it's 12, which I guess some of them got to get put in the toes, if that's the case.
So they gave a couple of the elves, couple of the dwarves, and the ones the humans went to the Wild West.
It's fun to compare this to Lord of the Rings, but you know what this is? It's fucking Dragon Ball.
Yeah, it is. It's straight up.
But we'll get to it. Hold on a second. The entire saloon gasps at the declaration. We learn from the nervous barkeep just how notorious these relics are. It is said that collecting all 12 of these rings will create a substance capable of resurrecting the dead and granting immortality, a substance known as zombie powder. Hmm. They're Dragon Balls.
Yeah, I was about to say, I feel like there's something else that if you collect them all can give you something really fucking OP.
This is the sole motive for everyone in this story. We just want to collect these things and be immortal. And there's no greater desire beyond that, no greater philosophy outside of just we're selfish Western bandits. In a world that makes no sense because it's the Wild West, but we also have a bus. Like, Google likes world-building detail, but not world-building detail that's actually relevant to the story. I find that admirable, but I don't know if I'm cool with it when it's just a constant barrage of unexplained world detail that I just kind of have to go like, oh, that's neat, and turn my brain off and not think about the ramifications of having public transportation in the Wild West or having a group of bandits that take over a city, but you could still call the police and there is a full-on circa 1998 police force that will come out with cars and sirens, right, and stuff. This is a very confusing world that Kubo's just like, it's just cool.
It's cool.
Yeah, I don't think Kubo gives a damn if I don't think this makes sense. He's just like, I just think it's fucking awesome. You know, yeah, whatever.
A couple of gunslingers in the bar respond to this proclamation by pointing their revolvers at the visitor in the hopes of taking what rings he already has. The visitor smirks at the challenge and turns to face off with the gunman, only to be met with a sucker punch from none other than Elwood, the young man from before. Elwood hastily apologizes as he makes a mad dash for the exit. The stranger, after regaining his bearings, realizes that his wallet's been stolen in the scuffle, but it doesn't take long for the visitor to catch up to Elwood. The young pickpocket immediately begs for forgiveness in what seems to be an overly rehearsed act. But the visitor lets the pickpocketing and the phony apology slide after seeing Elwood's scar-riddled hands. However, in return for this forgiveness, the visitor asks to be treated to a meal. We are pretty much introduced to the demeanor of our two main characters, Elwood and this visitor whose name we don't know yet. And the first thing that you notice, for me, that is like a Kubo aesthetic is character design. Like, I've always believed Kubo would be a fantastic fashion designer.
I think so, too. You know, he does a good job of visually showing what he's trying to set up from the beginning, so you know pretty much exactly how he wants you to take in these characters.
Thinking it better than being taken to the police, Elwood agrees to the deal. But little do the two of them know that a member of King Crow's gang, who recognizes the visitor, eavesdropped on their conversation and is none too pleased with what Elwood appears to be up to. We're then introduced to Elwood's sister, Cheryl, a loving but frail woman who acts more like a mother to the young man, as Elwood and his guest arrive home for the aforementioned meal. We get some lighthearted banter between the three characters, in which we finally learn the name of our visitor, Gamma Akutabi. Elwood can't put his finger on why that name sounds familiar, though. After the meal, Elwood shares a bit more about his life in a private chat with Gamma. When Gamma asks Elwood what drove him to pickpocketing, Elwood recalls how his family's business was destroyed by King Crow's gang, and how he had no choice but to work under him in order to acquire the money he needs for his sister's medication. When Gamma advises the young man to leave the gang for his own safety, Elwood lashes out and tells the visitor that it's none of his business. With nothing else to say, Gamma thanks Elwood for the meal and leaves into the night.
Sounds like Amazon.
What's that?
Sounds like Amazon. Take up all your jobs and not give you breaks, make you pee in a bottle.
Do I need to reread the chapter to find the part where Gamma's forcing Elwood to pee in a bottle?
No, it's King Crow.
King Crow. Oh, he's... Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah, King Crow comes in, destroys the business, and is just like, yeah, but, you know, we can offer you jobs.
Yeah.
Check out this bottle, though. It'd be a good place to put your piss.
Enjoy your two-second break.
The next morning, we see Elwood thinking on Gamma's words, only to be interrupted when an explosion blows a massive hole into the side of Elwood and Cheryl's home. It's King Crow and his gang, armed to the teeth with guns and a whole-ass bazooka. Just overly prepared to obliterate, like, these teenagers, and like where one of them has a mystery disease and the other one's 13 or something.
I guess just one and done, then you don't have to just pew, all gun.
Yeah. Keep in mind, there is a police in this town. They do mention that there are police. they don't give a shit. Like, oh, bazooka, I'm out. Thanks, though. The gang lord wants to know why Elwood was hanging out with the likes of a wanted criminal with a 960 million fantasy currency bounty. As he shows Elwood a wanted poster with Gamma's face and name, as well as his alias, the black-armed Shinigami. Elwood tries to explain himself, but a furious King Crow, convinced that Elwood attempted to hoard the bounty for himself, murders Cheryl and taunts the young man afterwards. What a fucking dick.
Yo, this part surprised the fuck out of me. I wasn't expecting them to just go with it, just be like, she's dead, suck it. It's just like, oh my God.
It's very odd to have the minor villain of a story be like, all right, I kill one of your major characters. I'm immediately like King Dick. One of those things that King I think you. I'm used to having that be used for like a major villain that's like, haha, I killed your sister. Right. See you in like 60 chapters in the conclusion of this epic arc where you get your revenge finally. No, I killed your sister. Do some shit. The heartbroken young man hurls a barrage of throwing knives at his former boss, but it takes little effort on King Crow's part to use one of his goons as a literal meat shield and eventually capture the enraged pickpocket. King Crow gives Elwood one last chance to give up the location of Gamma, but Elwood, having already accepted his fate, takes the opportunity to call King Crow a pig.
Yeah, you get him.
it's, you know, you got a bazooka aimed at your face that's just like, man, it's not going to be painful, so you might as well
talk a little shit.
And the way this guy grabs a goon and just like, let me just block the block these knives. And the rest of the goons are just cool with it. They're just like, it happens.
Yeah, that's why you don't stand too close to the boss.
It's very... I was going to rag on you for like, Amazon jokes for this fucking fat gangster. Sure, go ahead. But seeing how ununionized these goons are, they just see a guy get murdered and they're like, oh, that's just the fucking... That's what you get when you're working minimum wage, my dude. I think you're onto something.
Jeff Bezos is like, these are my Amazon body shields.
Come the revolution. That's going to be a job title on Indeed. I'm gonna
Jeff Bezos body shield.
I got a temp job. I seriously might have to consider that. Be like, the benefits are good. That's some good life insurance right there, being a meat shield. Luckily, just before he could pull the trigger, King Crow is suddenly launched across the room by a massive boot to the face. It's Gamma Akutabi coming in for the save and looking for a showdown with King Crow. The bloodied villain laughs to himself as he accepts Gamma's challenge for a good old rootin' tootin' old west duel. When prompted to bring out his piece, Gamma surprisingly enough reveals an unorthodox sword with serrated edges. The gang lord questions Gamma's sanity for bringing a sword to a gunfight, but our hero doesn't seem to mind the handicap. King Crow begins to count down the draw, but just as he reaches zero, the dastardly fiend orders his entire gang to open fire. The barrage of bullets is enough to bring an electrical pole down, which seemed a little out of place in an Old West, but anyway, it's not enough to bring Gamma down. Our hero reveals that long ago, he grafted a sheet of iron onto his right arm for the sole purpose of catching bullets out of the air. The very sight of Gamma's cold black hand pouring out dozens of crushed bullets causes King Crow's entire gang to flee.
Now that is pretty badass. I will give it that.
Let's do a quick little count. This is cool superpower number one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It's very cool superpower number one of having an arm capable of catching bullets. And it is cool. It is very aesthetically pleasing. This pure black arm just pouring out bullets. Kubo knows how to draw cool. Finally, Gamma can have his one-on-one showdown with the gang leader. He revs up his sword and reveals that his particular weapon is actually a motherfucking chainsaw with a hilt, which I want to count as superpower number two.
Yeah, that's pretty up there.
A frantic King Crow fires a desperation bazooka shell at the S-class criminal, only for Gamma to stop the rocket with his iron hand and eat the explosion. Elwood, thinking on how Gamma has survived the bullet-riddled West with just his sword, looks on in shock as Gamma proceeds to slice open his sister's murderer. We then cut to a few days after the incident. Gamma and Elwood grieve at the grave of Cheryl. Gamma offers the money found at King Crow's hideout, but Elwood refuses it. Instead, he wants to travel with Gamma in order to find the zombie powder and attain the power to bring his sister back. Gamma is reluctant to bring Elwood along, going so far as to threaten the boy's life if he decides to follow him. But when Elwood returns the threat right back at Gamma, the black-armed Shinigami relents and brings Elwood along to the next stop of his journey.
It's like, well, his sister's dead, and he doesn't really, he's lost everything, so he's like, fuck it. You know what, I'll take this kid.
And like, he's like, all right, here's the thing. If you follow me, I'm going to murder you. How's that? Elwood's like, I'll murder you first.
All right, you little motherfucker. I didn't think I'd say that, huh?
It's like, all right, you little shit. Go ahead and get yourself packed up. Let's fucking go.
Yeah.
Let's go fucking find the Dragon Balls. On the way to the next town on their bus route, Gamma shows off the single ring in his possession and shares his reason behind finding zombie powder to become immortal. After arriving at the town of Waltonville, the two powder hunters head into a music store that apparently acts as a front for some kind of secretive criminal or powder-related organization. It's not very clear. In any case, the organization provides Gamma with information, courtesy of a mysterious partner, regarding the location of another ring. This is, again, another rule of cool world-building thing,
yeah,
where there are music stores where you can go and get an album that has your name and you go to the cashier and be like, hey, I want to give this a listen. And the cashier's like, oh, you're this guy. Let me take you in for a private listening. And then you get a message of some kind. This is all really cool and all. And then you realize that this world has phones.
Yeah.
And I'm suddenly like, why the whole big old secrecy?
I mean, it is pretty cool. Like, I mean, if I had the option to run a music store and have like some cool secret, you know, meaning behind things where I could do stuff like that, yeah, I'd jump at that chance. But like, you could also just call up your buddy and be like, oh, it's over here.
I get it. Kubo just wants to be like, wouldn't it be cool if a music store was the front to a secret organization that serves no purpose that a phone doesn't serve? But, you know, whatever. It's cool.
Okay.
I get it, Kubo. I want to be cool like you, Kubo. I accept it. I'll stop questioning it. I'm sorry. Eventually, Gamma and Elwood get into a spat regarding Gamma's need to keep Elwood in the dark about certain details of the mission, causing the two to bitterly split off. This results in Elwood once again getting captured by bandits looking to get at Gamma, and Gamma once again rescuing his young ward with some good old-fashioned slicing and dicing. Gamma questions how prepared Elwood is to be traveling alongside a notorious criminal with a massive bounty, but Elwood insists that he's already made his decision and that he's not as helpless as Gamma thinks he is. And with that beef once again squashed, our heroes are on their way to the next arc of the series. Opening chapters are fine. They're fun.
That's pretty much how I feel as well. You know, the characters were interesting, but nothing like too out there. The motivations were pretty bland. The art is cool for the characters, but there's not much going on in the background.
If I really, really think about it, I hate this manga. But Kubo is so cool. I don't have time to think about this. God,
yeah,
so edgy.
When I got to this part, I can understand its appeal, but there was nothing that caught me that I would be like, just really driving to know more.
This takes us to our first actual arc of the series, the Gringeller arc, chapters 3-8. Gamma and Elwood get kidnapped by a gang of powder-hunting bandits and their hired gun, a dapper and unassuming gunslinger by the name of C.T. Smith. Smith and Gamma fight on even footing in a close battle up until Elwood gets held hostage by the bandits, again, forcing Gamma to surrender. Elwood kind of sucks in the opening chapters.
Yeah, he's just kind of in the way.
At the Bandit HQ, things look bleak for our imprisoned heroes. But when C.T. Smith assassinates the bandit keeping watch over the prison cell and releases Gamma and Elwood, it's revealed that Smith is actually Gamma's partner, and that getting captured was simply Gamma's way of getting access into the Bandit HQ, which is rumored to have a ring on the premises. They did a Joker!
They did. They literally did a Joker.
They did a Dark Knight Joker way back in, like, 1999? That's some foresight. There was this period in time where literally every film had fucking, oh, you've captured me, huh? Psych! And just busted out. I guess that doesn't happen a lot with protagonists, but...
Yeah, usually the villain, so...
Also, we get introduced to C.T. Smith, who is just also very cool. And not much else. He comes in and he fights with a suitcase and just a regular old pistol. And he's dressed like a businessman, and he is going toe-to-toe with the garish Sephiroth-looking, chainsaw-wielding, metal-armed, create a character that is Gamma. And it's definitely a clash of aesthetics, but, like, I like that. I like the fact that, you know, not everyone looks like they're in the same story. They all have their own individual stories that have influenced their aesthetics and upbringing and whatnot. It makes for a diverse cast.
Yeah, it helps them stand out.
Elwood is shocked by this development, but is grateful to have Smith on their side as he and Gamma proceed to tear the entire building apart. In the middle of this rampage, Elwood hears the cries for help of a young girl and insists that the group take a detour to investigate. Sure enough, the screams take the group to a room conspicuously labeled the torture room, where a young brother and sister are being tortured for information.
You always have to have that room.
Nothing ruins a torture session more than someone coming in and be like, oh, shit, that's not the bathroom. My bad.
sorry.
After dispatching the room of thugs, Elwood and Gamma are quick to help the wounded and unconscious sister, only to be attacked from behind by the brother. The young boy is actually the leader of the bandits, the notorious powder hunter, Rainwater Calder. armed with a sword with rocket thrusters, takes Gamma on in what looks to be a close matchup. As Elwood and Smith watch on, Smith comes to the realization that Calder can't be as young as he appears, and reveals that the bandit leader is actually extremely old and is using an experimental drug to maintain his youth. The incredibly vain Calder is annoyed that Smith is able to piece this together, but not as annoyed as Gamma, who had been holding back and fighting with his offhand in order to keep the kid alive. With no reason to hold back, Gamma unleashes his ultimate technique, the Karenzanjutsu, a sword style that inexplicably allows the user to control tendril-like black flames that manipulate objects. With this technique, Gamma is able to kill Calder with relative ease despite the length of the fight, and afterwards, Gamma and the gang quickly rescue the other prisoners, steal a ring of the dead for their trouble, and destroy the facility in the space of one chapter.
Everything happened so much.
This was a very short arc with a lot going on, but there's a big portion of it. Like, okay, here's one thing you start to realize with the series. There is not a single chapter at this point that doesn't have some kind of fight scene.
Yeah, there's cool fight scenes. He writes the fight scenes very well. He draws it very well. Easy to follow what's going on. And, you know, there's the tropes where Gamma's like, I've been holding back because I thought he was a kid. Oh, he's not a kid? Fuck him. That kind of stuff is pretty cool. I do like that kind of trope.
Also, we're introduced to the sword style of the Karenzanjutsu. That's superpower number 3. You officially have too many superpowers.
Yeah.
And it's amazing because they introduce it as like an ancient sword technique. And it's like, oh, okay, he's going to like show a different way of manipulating the sword and do some like Demon Slayer breathing techniques.
Right.
No, it's magic. It's literally just, I'm going to summon black flames because I'm so good with swords. What?
Yeah. Yeah. I hate when things pull from nothing. When your character is limited on what they can do, it results in more interesting ways of you dealing with fights. You see why JoJo Part 5 and other parts of JoJo are very successful, because your stand can do a whole bunch of crazy shit, but it's limited to that one gimmick. And you damn well better hope that your one gimmick can get around whatever the one gimmick of your enemy is. But if you have a character who doesn't have just one gimmick, he's not limited to something, doesn't make it as thrilling, doesn't make it as exciting as it could be.
But yeah, that wraps up that quick little arc, and that takes us to the Alcantara arc, chapters 9 through 24. The arc opens up with an introduction of the self-proclaimed journalist of justice, the beautiful and braggadocious Wolfgangia Ghetto. Wolfiana for short. We see her as she takes salacious photos of a notorious gang leader in drag for the purpose of kink-shaming him in a nationally published tabloid. This whole confrontation between Wolfiana and this particular gang leader has not aged well at all.
Nope.
We then cut to our heroes as they rest in the city of Alcantara. As Smith and Elwood talk about the latest tabloid issue in their hotel room, Gamma tries to get in contact with an informant on a payphone outside. Before returning to the others, Gamma is rudely interrupted by a woman jumping off of a roof and crashing into him. It's Wolfiana, running from the irate gang of outed outlaws whose reputation she tarnished. The gang leader eventually corners the young girl and demands an explanation. Wolfiana explains that she caught the gang attempting to sexually assault a girl, which gives her plenty of reason to make their lives hell. People who use dirty methods to hurt others, she dramatically exclaims, will be destroyed by methods even dirtier than theirs.
So that's implying a bit, considering what she was accusing them of.
I would say that in 2020, if the plan is cancel these people through public outrage, just reporting on the fact that they are sexually assaulting women is a pretty good way to go about it.
Right.
Without being like, oh, but actually the story is that they're cross-dressers. It's just, again, this whole thing reads really, really weird.
That like old homophobic base humor that back then people was like, ah, ha, ha, and then you realize,
This was the one bit that made me be like, oh, yep, that's the year 2000.
Yep. I saw it, I was like, oh no.
Having heard enough bluster, the gang members try to take her down, only to be met with a thrashing when Gamma and Wolfiana, armed with her trusty tripod, team up to take the lot of them down. After the scuffle, Wolfiana makes a quick exit, but Gamma is quick to track her down after a few more precarious encounters with their enemies and allies around town. Gamma eventually asks the journalist for information regarding a ring of the dead in town. Wulfiana is hesitant to give up what she knows, going so far as to call it a fairy tale that an adult like Gamma shouldn't bother with, but eventually gives in to Gamma's request, escorting him to the source of these flimsy rumors, the local hospital. However, just as Gamma and Wulfiana are inside of the building, they notice a troop of suspicious-looking individuals out front. Outside the hospital, a mustachioed vaudeville act of a villain, known as Balmuk the Mystic, threatens the chief doctor with violence if he doesn't get out of his way. The doctor, an elderly and gentle-looking man named Dr. Roscoe, refuses to put his patients at risk and stands firm, forcing the dastardly villain to go through with his promise. Luckily, Wulfiana and Gamma are in time to make the save in dramatic fashion. The malcontent magician has no choice but to make his exit, but promises to return with every intention of bringing Gamma down and taking the ring for himself. The scene is actually very weird. The magician-looking villain pulls a gun out of his ear, and before he can fire, Wulfiana comes in for the save and says, "Ha-ha, I'm going to fight you and scare you off again." No, you're not, because I'm going to make a tiger suddenly appear.
Yeah, boom, suddenly a whole-ass tiger. Good luck.
And then suddenly Gamma says, "No, you're not," and just punches the shit out of this tiger.
Yeah, he just one-punches this poor-ass tiger, just gone.
This is not an especially gruesome manga. It's not, like, gory or violent, but this scene of Gamma was actually gross. I think it was just the fact that, like, I did not expect that kind of brutality.
I remember when I got to this part, I was actually eating, and I just sat there with, like, my spoon, and as I flipped the page and you see that, I just, like, stood there with my mouth open with, like, the spoon next to my mouth just hovering, and I was just like, okay, all right.
Rip tiger.
Yeah.
Because I could imagine a lot of shonen heroes that are like, they subdue the tiger and the tiger's like, "Oh, I love you," as a sign of like how they have an animal magnetism. Nah, fucking Gamma's just like, "Fuck this tiger."
So it's been the first time I've had to deal with a tiger. It's gone.
Just explodes this tiger, and then we're just going to go and be like, "Yeah, Gamma's the hero." I'm like, "Gamma, you fucking murdered a tiger."
No, that was crazy.
Like, who has to clean up that tiger? It's just right outside of a hospital. I doubt that's...
Dr. Roscoe's like, "God damn it. This happens every Thursday.
All these exploding tigers in the Wild West." We then cut to the inside of the hospital, where Gamma, Wulfiana, and Dr. Roscoe are more than happy to dump some exposition on each other. Gamma explains that it's very possible that there is a patient in the hospital who the rumored ring is currently residing in. Gamma, in a demonstration that nearly destroys his left arm, shows that touching the gem of a ring causes grotesque arms to dig into the flesh of the victim in order to hide in their body to sap their life force from the inside.
Brandon, now! That's like the most metal thing I've heard.
This is suddenly the most gruesome black metal manga on the planet. Like, we just got so fucking edgy with these exploding tigers and these alien arms that come and reach and sap your life force.
But they're like baby hands. They look like the baby hands you buy at the store.
They look like fetch. They look like chunk little baby hands coming out to dig into you. With this information, Dr. Roscoe explains that there is only one patient that fits these symptoms. Emilio Ghetto, the comatose brother of Wulfiana. We get a quick flashback of how Emilio came to acquire the ring as a child, how it resulted in the child's sudden comatose state, and how much the event impacted Wulfiana's identity to this day. Gamma insists that Emilio be moved somewhere else before Balmuk returns, but the prideful doctor refuses. Later that night, Wulfiana takes Emilio's body out of the hospital against the doctor's wishes in order to transport him. Before she can take off, however, Gamma tells her to give Emilio over to him, sending Wulfiana into a rage as she rides into the night.
He's trying to, like, be like, "I'll help you." But instead of, like, saying anything, like, meaningful, impactful, Gamma's just like, "Give me your brother." And of course, she's going to react bad to that. And then he immediately is like, "Oh, shit, I didn't say that right. Oh, no.
Yeah.
I fucked up."
I love that Elwood comes out with Smith right after Wulfiana leaves the scene, and Elwood is like, "You idiot! What the..."
Yeah.
Fucking opens up with, "Hand over your brother."
Of course, like, she's gonna react like that.
You're stupid as hell.
That's another one for our we need to see how many manga that we can review where the the main character is a himbo. I will go ahead and check him off in that category.
Goku has fucked up everything for everyone. Right?
The Super Saiyan himbo standard.
What'd you have before Goku? You had fucking Kenshiro? You had, like, intelligent bad motherfuckers. And Goku came in and said, what if the strongest person alive was a complete idiot? And now every fucking strongest person alive is an idiot.
Yeah, pretty much.
In the barren wasteland of the desert, Wolfiana rides alone on her motorcycle, only to be enveloped in a massive circus tent. It's Balmuk the Mystic and his troop of carnival-themed henchmen. With Wolfiana quickly restrained by sword-wielding clowns, Balmuk monologues for just enough time to allow Gamma, with Smith and Elwood in tow, to tear into the circus tent and save Wolfiana. Gamma explains that he asked for Emilio because he knows someone that might be able to remove the ring safely. He didn't let me finish. I told you to give me the body so I could be so I could have the solution that helps, you dummy. Now we have to have a fight in the circus tent. Unfortunately, through the power of some magician bullshit, Balmuk absconds with Emilio and puts them on a magical train heading to parts unknown. Wolfiana takes off after the train while the rest of the group is forced to fight their way out of the maze of a circus tent.
That is absolutely Balmunk's ability is magical bullshit.
It's just, I fucking make your bullshit disappear, like, and it's in my bullshit now.
I weighed my cape, and not only can I make there be a tiger, but I have a whole circus and a train. Goodbye, fuckers.
Deuces, bitches. And I'm thinking to myself, like, okay, a better manga would make it a mystery of, like, how is he doing this magical bullshit? What kind of, you know, 3D printing Wild West shenanigans are making these things suddenly appear and da, 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 da. And they do that for some of the gimmicks, but for the most part, we're just to assume like he's fucking magic. Don't give me fights of people that are just my power is literally anything.
Clearly defined abilities and limitations are what make it interesting, and it has neither.
This was not the villain that you spend, what did that say? It's like 20 chapters on this arc based around this one villain.
Yeah.
So much of the world is undefined to bring in characters whose power types are undefined. It just feels like the artist, and God bless you, Kubo, you have the right to draw whatever you want. But Kubo's just, I want to draw cool shit. I don't really want to explain the cool shit.
Yeah.
It's okay, Kubo. I still love you. I still want to be, you're still the coolest. This leads to 8 straight chapters of fighting, where each of our heroes are split up from each other and forced into combat against weird circus lieutenants. Gamma mercilessly kills an obnoxious swordsman with a Hans Moretti sword box gimmick. Elwood takes on a flame-throwing fire eater in a fight that shows that he's not just baggage to the group. And Smith does the suddenly behind you nothing personal kid shtick to a knife thrower and 20 of his sisters.
He literally does.
Smith does the cleanest, most cliche, like, oh, you think you're fast?
Yeah.
I'm already behind you, you little bitch, and just shoots him in the back of the head.
He even has, like, the fedora tip as well. As
oh, my God. And then the villain gets shot in the head and is still cognizant enough to be like, what? No, your secret identity, it's actually... God. Smith might be my favorite character because he's the one that's unabashedly edgy.
Yeah, yeah, same actually. Smith is everything. Like, I would have read this manga as a kid and I would have loved Smith.
There are times when I read older manga where I see a trope and I'm like, they're doing the thing. They did the thing here. And one thing that comes to mind is Yu Yu Hakusho. When doing the Dark Tournament arc and they have the guy with the big, they have the guy with the big axe and he takes his armor off because the armor was actually a seal for his immense power.
Yep.
I saw that like 20 years after the fact. And I was like, that's the thing.
That's the thing.
That's the fucking thingy. They do the shtick. And I got that exact feeling with this. I don't think Kubo invented the nothing personal kid. But then again, how much of that was happening in 1999?
Right.
Maybe he really did just invent the fucking nothing personal kid.
Or at least, like, add to it becoming a thing. I would feel like whoever it first came from, plus the people who were like, I like this trope, and added it in, definitely get credit for building it up to become such a meme.
I mean, with Bleach, he definitely popularized it.
Oh, yeah.
But I really want to have some kind of Shonen Jump historian go through, like,
everything to see if there was ever an instance of a fucking pshing, nothing personal kid.
Before this. I would love
because
to see
this one is played so deadpan and edgy that it's endearing in 2020.
It really tickled me. It was one of the moments that, you know, I was reading this and being like, eh. But I got to that part and I did actually laugh. It's like, this is wonderful.
We eventually cut back to the train just as Wolfiana catches up and boards it. Bald Monk, after waiting for her arrival, proceeds to restrain the young girl and gaslight her into thinking that she's the reason that Emilio was eaten by the ring and that she's actually an awful sister.
What an asshole.
He's literally just like, oh, wow, you came to save your brother. You're just a bitch.
Yeah.
Just the word.
She's like, what?
And Wolfiana, man, she falls for this gaslight hard. Like, she is so demoralized.
This kind of stuff frustrates me because, like, having that doubt and having it be a plot point, it's interesting and it'd be really cool, but it'd be even better if she, like, rationalized that at some point in the fight and then be like, all right, it's time to be super badass. But, yeah, she really falls for it hook, line, and sinker here, and it was a little bit disappointing.
But just as Wolfiana is about to lose hope, Gamma comes in for another fucking save, this time by catching up to the train on a motherfucking unicycle.
All right.
From here, Gamma finally faces off against Bald Monk in an intense fight. No, you know what? No. You know, wait. We gotta stop.
We're just gonna gloss over the unicycle.
I tried to ignore it, but here's the deal. If you are really, really fast on a unicycle, you are really, really fast at running.
Yeah.
You just run. Just run after the fucking train. I don't think there's any advantage to unicycling because it's not like you're not converting energy to the fucking wheel to like get more out of your fucking power. It's one wheel. It's just the ability for you to make a full rotation with your feet. That's a full rotation with the wheel. So it's fucking useless.
You mean to tell me this is the Wild West, we're chasing a train, and everyone knows what the terrain is like out in the Wild West? You mean to tell me that he could just unicycle his ass straight all the way up there? Like, no, you can run faster than you could unicycle over the rocky-ass terrain of the Wild West.
It threw me for a loop, especially right after the scene of this poor girl about to cry her eyes out because she's giving in to the despair of being a terrible sister. And then here comes fucking Gamma. Ring, 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 just fucking blazing it.
Like, no.
From here, Gamma finally faces off against Bald Monk in an intense fight. We learn a little bit about Gamma's dark past throughout the fantastical exchange and get a glimpse at what seems to be a bloodthirsty second personality to Gamma. Fourth superpower. Secret, dark, edgy side.
I'm even more edgy. I'm even more like Sephiroth than you thought.
Regardless, our hero is eventually able to disarm, i.e. remove the arms of the magician, leading to his hasty and desperate escape. After defeating Bull Monk's henchmen, saving Emilio, and eventually stopping the runaway magic train, our heroes can finally lick their wounds at the hospital the next morning. Wolfiana takes the opportunity to thank Dr. Roscoe for doing so much to care for her brother before taking her leave with the rest of Gamma's crew to meet with his contact and finally cure her brother, thus ending this massive fucking arc.
Yeah.
Certainly the longest arc, certainly the most defining arc of this series, and for me, certainly the weakest in terms of writing and pacing. Some of the fighting is fun, but it's not revolutionary and it's not exactly pushing the expectations for shonen. I actually think Elwood's fight in this is the strongest fight in terms of finally giving him an opportunity to not just be fucking dead weight.
Right.
And showing some creativity in the fight. And that's a character that Kubo has given defined limits. He is a weak jabroni who's only capable of, like, throwing knives. And he's going up against a flamethrower, so he has to be creative with how he's able to reverse the situation. That's actually, in my mind, the only fight in the series that uses a rule set and expectations in a fight in order to give a satisfying conclusion in a creative way.
And other than our fedora-tipping moment with Mr. Smith, that fight with Elwood is the only, I think, the only memorable fight of this whole manga.
I agree. Or, like, at least the most emotionally impactful.
Yeah.
This takes us to the closing chapters of the series, chapters 25 through 27. In the city of New Caraway, our heroes continue their journey towards Gamma's specialist. Smith makes a call to the specialist in question, who confirms that they've already sent someone to pick them up. We get a bit where Wolfiana makes soup for everyone, and it's disgusting, followed by a tense conversation between Smith and Gamma concerning a secret condition that Gamma needs medication for, because he doesn't have enough things going on in his character, so let's give him a secret disease as well. Sure. Elwood rescues a young girl from some thugs and then learns that the girl, a bubblegum pop teen with psychic powers by the name of Angele Cooney, is the person assigned with taking Gamma and the gang to the specialist. We cut to another tense conversation between Gamma and Wolfiana about Gamma's reluctance to share anything about his past, prompting a series of flashback images showing characters that probably would have been covered if we weren't in the middle of being canceled. Angele finally meets up with the rest of the gang and proceeds to teleport everyone to the specialist's facility. We finally get to meet the specialist.
Before we get to the specialist, I have to point out that... Yes. So in the previous arc, I was pretty much like on my way to being like, all right, I'm pretty done with this. It overstayed its welcome. And then if you want to talk about a section that absolutely does not hold up now and should have not held up then.
Oh, yeah.
When Angele shows up, she is the most problematic character in this manga. She shows up and she's all like, I'm in love with Gamma, and she's like fucking 11, and then Gamma's like, I won't kiss you till you're 15. It just pissed me off. I was like, I am so done.
Yeah, this was not it, and really isn't in 2020. And you know, shit like this. Guess what? Welcome to Shonen Jump year 2000. It's one of the fucking bits of baggage you get from reading older manga.
Right.
And the older you get, the worse you get. Like, the second chapter of Dragon Ball involves Goku sexually assaulting Bulma in her sleep. Well, man, this was a time for just normalizing the shit out of some pretty problematic expectations of young girls. And Angele is definitely the low point in terms of character writing and character design for the entirety of the series. So, yikes.
Yeah, that was a hard yikes from me.
We finally get to meet the specialist, a stone-cold bitch with a harem of maids by the name of Nazna Gemini. She tells the group that she's able to extract the ring from Emilio, but only if Wolfiana volunteers for human experimentation for 1 year.
Jesus.
Wolfiana is shocked by the proposal, but agrees to the terms.
Oh my gosh.
Finally, the series ends with Smith and Gamma sneaking out in the middle of the night. Smith asks his partner if he's certain of his decision to leave Elwood behind, to which Gamma replies by saying he believes in the kid, regardless of whether he decides to follow them or not. As the two powder hunters walk towards the horizon, a station DJ can be heard from a nearby radio, again, Wild West.
Yeah, future also.
As he introduces the next song on the playlist titled Zombie Powder. And so ends the series of the very same name. Woo!
Yep.
So this is a series that you should not read.
Yeah, no.
It has not aged well. I honestly believe that manga has gotten more sophisticated in terms of writing, in terms of, you know, especially just Kubo's work. Because there's absolutely manga, you know, Fist of the North Star holds up. Early parts of JoJo are perfectly fine and fun to read. And One Piece is still a banger. But this has the appearance of something that's unique with a weird setting and weird character designs, but in terms of how the characters interact, in terms of what the stakes are, this is cookie cutter Shonen Jump. If you ever need to read something that's just, here is the bare minimum of what you can have in a battle manga, Zombie Powder pretty much scratches that itch. But at the end of the day, this is absolutely not a series that I would implore people to read for the sake of just, oh, Zombie Powder is a quality series without the context of Kubo, without the context of Bleach and, you know, other things. And I think that's true with how this series was marketed. Because Zombie Powder gets canceled, Bleach comes out, is a huge success, and Viz Media just says, well, fuck it. Bleach is such a big success. Why don't we just put out Zombie Powder since we have the rights to that? As like, hey, take a look at Kubo's other work.
Yeah.
And I think that's the best thing you can get out of Zombie Powder. It's an extension of Kubo the artist rather than a great story on its own.
Yeah, for sure. This series as a whole, just like Adam mentioned, I would not recommend anyone read this. Only under the context of you would want to see where Kubo failed in comparison to where he succeeded in Bleach. Out of that context, this is not a good manga. It doesn't have a good or compelling story or characters, battle mechanics, or powers. It has some cool moments here and there, but other than that, this is just one of those series that didn't try super hard and absolutely deserved to get canceled because it wasn't good.
I think one issue that comes with the series that I think he learns from in later series is that Kubo works well with worlds that have a strong restriction. This is a weird cyber futuristic Western where magic is a thing and psychics are a thing and sword arts with weird, you know, mystical techniques to them are a thing. And there's too much going on to actually give a coherent world, despite the fact that Kubo is doing all this weird stuff to make it feel like there's a coherent world. Like it's the year 798 AE. You can think about how that calendar originated and how this Western town became such a wasteland and da 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 da. With Bleach and with Burn the Witch, one thing that serves Kubo really well is the restriction of this is a high school kid. This is somebody that out of the gate maybe has a slight supernatural power, but for the most part is just a regular guy with a decent athleticism. Now, how do we build that character into a badass? And how do we accumulate superpowers in a way that is intriguing? And that's where having that like baseline of we can't have these superpowers busting out of the gate because they're just in high school. That's something that I think really helped Kubo find a focus that was vital to Bleach's success, that allowed Kubo more time to focus on really cool character designs, really cool character interactions, and really interesting fights that don't push the boundaries on expectations in terms of, you know, what these characters are capable of. In terms of whether or not this is a good series, I don't even think Kubo thinks is a good series. I'm giving it a 3. Everything that it does well feels very plain and vanilla, and everything that it's bad at, it's really bad at. And I would say a series like Zip Man that is also rule of cool driven action series with a lot of pacing that demands you stay high octane. If you're looking for that, stick with Zip Man, but I think this is a lesser version of that kind of constant high-octane battle-heavy writing and choreography and character design.
Yeah, I mean, I can absolutely agree with that. There's, at the same time, not a lot going on with this manga, but also a lot going on in this manga. But none of it quite hits. It misses the mark pretty far. And I think it was because, like Kubo mentioned, that he was listening to his editors a bit. He wanted to write something that was likable, I guess. He sort of like the critique we had in the last episode, like in the manga of Time Paradox Ghost Rider, where the editor was like, you gotta just go all out in one little thing. You don't want to write something that is gonna, you know, just appease, you know, whoever and have no originality to it. And I feel like that kind of fits in this scenario.
He was told to make something accessible when he wanted to write, you know, crazy stuff.
Yeah, and but at the same time, as the setting was also kind of lifted from other things, or at least inspired by other things. So In the time, I don't think it would have stood out at all. I think the reason it probably did so well in the West is because those character archetype and that kind of lawless West is something that Americans kind of enjoy. So I can see why it did well in the West. But in reading this the first time, I thought this is the most mediocre manga I've read on the show. Just flat-lined, you know, as middle of the road, as much of a C as you could go. But there were certain aspects between the problematic chapters towards the end, stuff that kind of dropped it below middle of the ground. So I think when I first finished this, I was going to give it like a straight up 5 or 4. But after really diving in and having a little extra time to look into the more details of this, I would also drop it down to that 3. I think that's where it comfortably sits.
And I don't think that is a ranking that would hurt Kubo's feelings. According to Kubo, in an interview a couple years ago, talking about Zombie Powder, he talks about how he was just so dejected going chapter to chapter. And the chapters that he actually enjoys most, and this will be to your chagrin, he loved the later chapters of the series. I think it has more to do with writing a lot more character interaction and emotion. I actually am a big fan of the confrontations between Gamma and Smith and Gamma and Wolfiana in those last couple of chapters. More of that would have added a lot of heart to the series that... it would have added a lot more of the heart to Zombie Powder that only came out when the series was already canceled, and does really show itself in some of the stronger early arcs of Bleach with the Grand Fisher arc.
I absolutely see this as as strange it is that we rate it so low, but I absolutely see this as sort of a success story overall. Because the things you're talking about with Gamma and Wolfiana talking, and she's upset that he's not opening up about his past, or when Gamma's talking with Smith about how much he sees himself in Illwood and that he wants to make sure he doesn't go down the same path. That is the kind of stuff that I thought I did enjoy. And in that way, you do see where that leads into Bleach in many facets. And I can see where while some problems still exist going into Bleach, I can see where a lot of improvements were made when you compare these two side by side.
I've always said, I don't want this to be a dunk podcast where we talk about oh, this is such a crappy series, look how crappy it is. It's something where some stories don't work, but that's something to learn from. There's value in that. And I think in terms of the manga we're going to be talking about that got a 3 out of 10, just because we can look back and see what the ramifications of Zombie Powder ended up being, Zombie Powder is probably the most successful 3 out of 10 manga that we'll be talking about in this series. It's for sure Vital to the coolest freaking mangaka to ever grace us with his majesty.
He's too cool.
Thank you so much for listening in to the Shonen Fiasco show. You can check us out on any other place you got, your podcast, your Spotify's, your iTunes, your Podchasers. Last episode, I said we'd be working on a YouTube, and that's still in the works, but give us a break. We're two people. Stop with the bullying.
No
bully. We're trying our best. No bully.
The music for this episode's pitch is from The Game Brass, video game music brass quintet, classically trained. We just finished releasing our Brassino Isles Tropical Cruise album this summer, and we have a new album coming out very soon, and that's all I can say right now.
Next episode, we are going to be reviewing and discussing Hell Warden Higuma and talking about the awkwardness of getting canceled because, we can only have one Demon Slayer.
No way.
This is my dude. Thank you so much for listening in to the Shonen Fiasco show. I am Adam Tetramore.
And I am Alex Hill.
Be sure to read everything.
So cool. Kubo.
More like Cool Bro.
Cool Bro.